you know HeritageRadioNetwork.org is a member-supported nonprofit organization. If you like what you're listening to, go to our website and click that donate button. Become a member and get special discounts, invites, VIP treatment, t-shirts, and more. Support us in our mission to bring you the freshest food content in the nation. Today's program has been brought to you by Tabard Inn, new American cuisine in one of Washington, D.C.'s oldest hotels, located in DuPont Circle. For more information, visit TabardInn.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit HeritageRadioNetwork.org for thousands more.
Thank you for tuning in to the Heritage Radio Network. We are coming to you live from the back of Roberta's Pizza in beautiful Bushwick, Brooklyn. And this is a community session. I'm your host today, Erin Fairbanks, and we are in line for a very special panel discussion on the FFLP. And today we are joined in the studio to discuss the Farmworker Fair Labor Practice Act by John Cronin Jr. He's an organizer for Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York, Rock NY. John, welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also in studio, we have Maggie Gray. She's assistant professor of political science at Adelphi University. Thanks for being with us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And then by phone, we have Wade McMullen. He's staff attorney for Partners for Human Rights. Wade, are you with us?
I'm here. Thanks so much for having me.
And also by phone, Librata Paz. She's on the board of directors in Western New York for the Rural and Migrant Ministry. Librata, welcome.
Thank you.
So we are going to be discussing the Fair Labor Act, and I wanted to kind of begin the discussion with some of the basic points that are included here. So the enact. The bill goes to enact Farm Workers Fair Labor Practices Act, looking to grant collective bargaining rights to farm laborers, looking to require employers of farm laborers to allow at least 24 consecutive hours of rest each week, looking to require an overtime rate at 1.5 times the normal rate. It makes provisions of unemployment insurance law applicable to farm workers, provides for the eligibility of farm workers for workers' compensation benefits, provides for a 10-hour workday for farmers. As I go down this list, it's hard for me to find out like what on it jumps out as a thing that anyone would really be against. And so I think we're hopeful to tuck into some of the reasons that we haven't seen this bill enacted. And I wanted to start by going kind of around the group and giving everyone an opportunity to talk a little bit more about their work and kind of how they came to be an advocate on this issue. And I think Maggie will probably start with you. If you want to give us a little sense of your background and why it is that, you know, you came here and felt compelled to speak on the bill today.
Sure. So I'm an assistant professor. This is my research area is on non-citizen workers in the food industry. And my first major project has been on New York State farm workers and this legislation in particular. Really come about it from an academic background in labor rights and human rights. And also I worked for 10 years on social and economic justice in the nonprofit sector. So that's a little bit of my background.
Nice. And coming to the bill today, is there any particular aspect that jumped out at you as something that you're particularly interested in or affronted by or a message that you feel is kind of most important to get across?
So I think I'm here really to just give some context based on my research about happy to talk about the way this influences the daily lives of farm workers and you know, the challenges that farmers currently face and the sort of challenges they might face if this bill were passed.
And Librata, how about yourself? How is it that you come to speak on these issues?
Of course, I mean, I speak on these issues too because I was a farm worker by myself and also working, having the experience in having the difficulty of how hard it is to be as a farm worker working under, you know, all weather conditions and no protections in many ways. And also that's why, I mean, it is important to educate people to hear us about the awareness of what's going on, because these workers need the equal rights, because, you know, I mean, it is such a hard work. And then besides that, being excluded on the basic rights, so I think it's just not fair. So my point is to basically educate in the community and then get support to support the viewers for the farm workers, right? Because, like I say, it just we're just actually adding that race that has been excluded for so long, and that's what we try to do.
And can you tell us a little bit more about the Rural Migrant Ministry? What type of work is it that the organization does?
Rural Migrant Ministry, what they do is that they actually the same thing, educating the community. I mean, educating the people, educating the allies, the students, the farm workers, and very much, you know, around education about the farm workers' rights. And they do lobby, they do, events, so all those type of things to educating people.
Okay, and Wade, now you're a staff attorney. How is it that you come to these issues, and what is your particular perspective?
Hi, Erin. I come to these issues because I work for an organization called the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights. And the RFK Center is an international human rights organization that was founded in 1968 by Robert Kennedy's friends and family to carry on his unfinished social justice work. And I work on a number of issues, human rights issues around the world. And one thing that one human rights issue that was very dear to Robert Kennedy's heart was the plight of farm workers in the United States. And so I come to this from an international human rights-based perspective to advocate on behalf of farm workers and equal rights that Labrada has just mentioned.
Thank you. And John, as an organizer for the Restaurant Opportunity Center of New York, you know, not obviously like a farm perspective. So where in the chain of conversation do you and your organization fit in?
The right word that you use is actually chain. I'm here to represent the Food Chain Workers Alliance, which is a coalition of worker-based organizations that represent workers along the food chain. And by food chain, we mean people that engage in production, processing, distribution, retail, and food and service production, and farm workers are in that. And so we're actually the Rural and Migrant Ministry is a member of the Food Chain Workers Alliance, so it's nice to have someone else on there with us. So it's really to stress the fact that when it's come that locally grown food, small farmers, organic has been something that's been really big and really a great development over the last few years, that it's come to light and become so popular. But the plight of the people that serve that food, that pick the food, and that process the food is something that hasn't come to the forefront as much, which is why something like the Farm Workers Bill is so needed. So I possibly was able and am going to be able to provide a little context to not only the farm workers, but why do we need change along the whole food chain. Just the food chain itself is the largest private sector in the United States, and it employs 1/6 of the entire workforce, and about 20 million workers. So the Food Chain Workers Alliance seeks to kind of unite workers in solidarity of their campaigns, but also engage consumers to think about fair wages and working conditions for the workers who produce, package, transport, cook, and serve our food. And myself, I was a waiter and busboy, a restaurant worker for about 12 years, and didn't receive any benefits or good working conditions. And so I would serve very fine food and not seek the benefits of it.
Sure. I mean, I think we'll probably keep coming back to that issue of kind of who's working in the food system and who's paying what and how folks are benefiting. Well, I want to get a sense of context here, because this is a state bill and it is particular to New York State. And I don't know, maybe you can help give us a sense of context of how New York State may differ from other parts of the country with regards to farming and farm workers.
Sure. I guess we should just start with a tiny history lesson. So when during FDR's New Deal, there was legislation focused on, you know, bringing us the weekend and the eight-hour day and the minimum wage, et cetera, et cetera. And at the time, farm workers were left out of a fair amount of this legislation alongside domestic workers. A lot of this having to do with a very strong Southern Democratic control in the Senate that was able to say, hey, you know, you start giving rights to our workers and it's going to be expensive for us. So there's a historical legacy nationally, and this is the federal legislation, is that farm workers don't have a right to a day of rest, don't have a right to overtime pay, and don't have collective bargaining protections, among others. So I think for so many people, they, you know, their memory of farm worker issues is about Cesar Chavez, is about Bobby Kennedy. And Bobby Kennedy toured upstate New York to talk about farm labor issues. So you've got a handful of states around the country that do have labor laws that are stronger than the federal standards. So, for example, in California, where you have, you know, collective bargaining protections. This is, of course, the heart of the United Farm Workers movement. And a handful of states, I think 10 states, offer overtime protections. So New York is not alone in neglecting to offer these rights to workers. And the campaign for farm worker justice with the Fair Labor Practices Act has been going on for more than a decade, trying to get this similar legislation passed that would, it's essentially an omnibus bill that would extend all of these rights, aiming to get equal rights for farm workers in the same way that another type of worker might have those rights.
And is there any other group of workers that you're aware of that is excluded from those types of protections that are similar to farm workers?
Yes. So domestic workers. And Domestic Workers United is a really interesting organization here in New York. And a few years ago, the New York State Legislature passed a Domestic Workers Bill of Rights, which extended to them many of the rights that farm workers are seeking. So it was a really historic moment of recognition for those workers. And during that same legislative season, the farm worker legislation, it failed by just a handful of votes in the New York State Senate.
So Wade, I'm kind of looking to you to give us a sense of international perspective of how maybe the U.S. Stacks up against other parts of the world with regards to farm workers and farm worker rights.
Yeah, it's a great question. I think that when you talk about comparing the U.S. internationally, that there's several issues that crop up. And one thing to add to the kind of brief history lesson that we've just heard is that in addition to the large economic incentive of these Southern Democrats back in the 1930s, there was also very strong racial animus at play when farm workers and domestic workers were excluded from U.S. federal labor protections. I mean, you can go back and read the legislative history and read the horrible statements that these Southern congressmen were saying about how the white man and the Negro cannot be paid equal wages, and they saw these labor protections as a route to a faster route to equality in the South. So there was the economic incentive for sure, but there was also a very much so, and you can read it in the legislative history, a discriminatory intent when excluding these two groups of people who made up the bulk of the jobs available to African Americans at the time. And now today you have these exclusions further discriminatorily impacting a minority and Latinos who make up the vast majority of farm workers in America today. So that's one area in which these farm worker exclusions that, you know, exclude farm workers from the basic rights afforded to almost every other American worker. That's one reason why, compared internationally, they have this awful discriminatory effect that you don't see in other countries. Likewise, you know, the right to collective bargaining is a fundamental international right, fundamental in UN treaties and the ILO organization as well. And, you know, you have countries such as Russia that are lambasting the U.S. at the U.N. and asking them about their rights record on farm workers and why farm workers don't have rights to collective bargaining, even though the United States has signed on to these international treaties saying that they will obligate themselves to grant these rights. Just recently, a UN human rights body sent a letter of inquiry to the United States to ask them about their compliance with a bunch of international human rights issues. I mean, you're talking drones and Guantanamo and all these things, and on that list of issues that they're concerned about is the lack of collective bargaining rights for agricultural workers. So it kind of gives you a little bit of a flavor of where we're coming from internationally.
And looking more kind of regionally to New York State, I know, Labrada, you've traveled and spoke on this issue for many years, and I'm wondering if you've noticed any difference with regards to the way workers are treated as you move to different parts of the state or as you move from different types of agriculture to, you know, from dairy production to vegetable production, if there's a shift in the way workers are treated or perceived, or if you feel like kind of uniformly, the issues are more or less the same across the state.
Yes, I think. I had a very little experience in different states while I was migrating, and I mean that was since 1988. And I mean, compared to other states, I think very much they are. I mean, very much the same, I would say so. I mean, as I remember, there were a lot of abuses in different way, in hard work, like always, I mean, running here, running there. And then if you're complaining, you get fired, or if you don't like the job, that's not what I have, and all those types of things. I think very much the same thing, though. But the point is, we're talking about here in New York State, I mean, since we're based in here, and then where my ministry is trying to do is that, okay, if we can catch this, then, I mean, let's make the other state to follow us, you know, and also follow us, as California did, too. So why not make it better for the farm workers? Because, I mean, like what we said, why we have been excluded and why not actually recognize this right? Because it's the hard work, I mean, it's really hard work, and at least keep the right to these people. So basically, I mean, that's what we're talking about. It doesn't matter. I mean, I guess my point is not to compare to different states, because it doesn't matter where you're going, you're still going to struggle in one thing or another thing. So the point is to pass it no matter where we are, I guess, you know. But right now we focus on New York State, so that's the point.
Now, I've heard kind of a response from farmers at different scales that the provisions in this bill aren't kind of designed to impact people equally across scale. There's no kind of consideration if you're a small scale farmer or if you're a larger scale farmer, that the provisions are applied equally across the board and that they would have differential impacts. And I'm wondering, maybe if you can maybe speak a little bit to why people might have this concern and why you feel like, or if you do feel like the bill kind of addresses those concerns.
Erin, I think your question gets to the heart of an issue that a lot of your listeners are very aware of. So it's this idea about small farmers and how small farmers are going to be affected. So I think, you know, the food movement, which has done so much wonderful awareness building about the way farming works, has largely neglected this issue. And I think in their neglect of this issue, what they've done is set up a false dichotomy. Okay, you've got your Michael Pollans and your Barbara Kingsolvers and others, and they have, you know, corporate industrial mega scale factory farms on the one hand, and on the other hand, you've got local farms, and that the larger industrial factory farms are the ones that are polluting the environment and mistreating animals, and this is where sustainability and lack of nutrition is coming out. And by contrast, that the small farms we're led to believe are much more wholesome. And I think we're led to believe that in every regard they're more wholesome. And where some of these prominent food writers do take on the issue of farm labor, it's largely to point to abuses in the industrial factory farm system. And what I can tell you from my research is that all of the conditions that workers face on those large factory farms, they face on farms in New York State. I've talked to workers on farms where there are 80 employees, 50 employees, 5 employees, 2 employees. And conditions are really similar. So I guess I would just want to put that out there. The work is the same. The conditions are the same. There's a lot of talk in the U.S. about trying to promote small business and protect small business, and an effort made, particularly around this legislation, to exclude the smaller farms. And I guess it's in the name of trying to protect them, imagining they're the most vulnerable. What I've actually seen is sometimes, especially on organic farms, on some CSAs, the ones that are small, they're actually paying their workers higher wages than on the farms where you have 50 or 60 workers. So I actually think a lot of the small farms are already paying workers more than what I've seen on some of these larger farms. And I think it really comes down to any employer imagining, you know, what's it going to mean to me if I have to start to pay overtime, if I have to give a day of rest. And the day of rest provision is not that it's a mandatory day of rest, but that workers would have the option to choose if they were going to work that day. And if they were going to work that day, they would be paid at overtime rates, not a flat rate. So, you know, really from the perspective of farmers, everything comes down to, you know, how does this affect my wallet? I'm sure you've done shows here. Every time the oil prices go up, transportation increases. The more you have corn production toward ethanol, feed prices go up. So I think for farmers, it's, you know, most of them that I've spoke to say we wish we could pay more. We'd like to treat them better. It's a shame how there's labor exploitation. And I think as a business person, and here we really need to be clear, we're talking about employers. We're talking about business people. When we talk about farmers, it starts to evoke very romantic agrarian ideas for us. But we're talking about business people, and it's really about a level of equity across the board for the same labor and the same conditions, about getting the same wages and same benefits.
And I'm just curious, John, if you would agree that, you know, is this a thing you hear from smaller businesses where they're like, oh, but we're a tiny restaurant and it's already so hard for us. Like, why don't you go after the larger corporate chains of the world? And organizationally, do you guys take the stance that, you know, rules should be made kind of across the board, or are there exceptions to be made? Yeah. Does that just get you into kind of murky waters?
We actually, the Food Chain Workers Alliance, put out a report last year called The Hands That Feed Us, which is a survey of all the worker organizations and the workers in those sectors that I mentioned earlier. And we found very similar things that Maggie was saying, is that a lot of the most employers said they would love to provide higher benefits. They would love to do this. They love to do that. But they don't actually practice it. And a lot of them would point to the competition to the large, big businesses. And this argument has even been used in various things, even here in New York City. For example, the opposition to paid sick days, the opposition to raising the minimum wage. And they would always bring up small companies, small business. But the ones who were backing the opposition to this was actually the big businesses. And they're the ones who have the most to lose. And it really is important to raise these conditions, because one thing I didn't mention before, I said that the food chain is the largest chain, but I didn't necessarily state some of the conditions. These are the people who are handling our food, and it's actually a public health risk. It's also human rights violations, where over 86% of the people along the food chain are in poverty or not earning a living wage, with close to 80% having no paid sick days, over 50 working while sick, over 35 have experienced some type of wage theft. So we have the people actually handling our food, going to work sick, not making any, going to work sick and not making wages to be able to food their family, to feed their families. And on that note, people along the food chain are on public assistance at twice the rate that the rest of the food sector is, as well as on food stamps and other things along that.
Yeah, Maggie, you wanted to jump in there?
Yeah, if I can jump in, I think John brings up a really important point. You know, we have so many foodies, especially not far from where we are right now in Brooklyn. And I think there's all this incredible concern about how our food is produced, right? What are the chemicals used around it? Is it seasonal? Are the animals treated with respect? How far does it have to travel? What's the effect on the environment? And we have a lot of conversations about sustainability. And I think that the farm worker cause fits squarely into this conversation, right? I mean, if we're talking about sustainability, we should be discussing sustainable jobs that go with this, you know, amazing meal that's on my plate. So I think really connecting it to the food movement that way can help people better, it can help better resonate. And I think one of the problems, you know, when you initially started the conversation, you said, you know, I'm trying to understand why people would fight against this. And I think in part our sympathies so lie with farmers. Right. And so in any conversation, if there's a farmer in the conversation, you know, this is where we imagine our nation is founded on farming. And especially for New York farmers, we know they're struggling, and we meet them in the farmer's market. And I think it's so easy for us to immediately have our sympathies with the farmer and to, you know, well, you know, we're supposed to have this relationship where we look them in the eye when we buy their food and we trust them. And so I think we really trust the fact when they tell us, you know, oh, this is going to put us out of business. This is going to hurt us so much. And I think that this is one of the main obstacles that the public has right now in terms of trying to figure out how to support a bill that they imagine could possibly hurt farmers.
Well, and
yeah, Aaron, could I jump in just
Please.
Quick? This is Wade. I just wanted to say that in addition to being, you know, this international lawyer, I actually grew up in Texas where my grandfather was a small-scale rancher, and so I totally sympathize with that nostalgia from, you know, our roots and our heritage and where our food is coming from with farmers. And just would like to echo the sentiments that have already been said and provide a little bit of statistics to say that, you know, 70% of farms in New York are these small farms that don't even hire any workers. So they don't contract for farm labor, and so they'll be unaffected by this. And the ones that do, like Margaret was saying, that actually want to pay their workers well, are up against these large businesses who have this subsidized cheap labor because they don't have to pay overtime pay. And if, you know, the big businesses were forced by law to provide overtime pay like every other business is to their workers, then the smaller farmers would actually be benefited in a sense, and the playing ground would actually be leveled in a sense for these kind of small scale farmers. And we hear a lot about family farms, and we must also be careful not to conflate the family farm with the small scale farm in the sense that because Walmart is, you know, owned by a family, and so we don't consider Walmart a family business. Walmart is a giant mega corporation in the same sense. You know, some of the largest farms in New York State are owned privately by families, but these aren't the same thing as the small-scale farmers that we see in the farmers market that might not even employ a farm worker.
Yeah, and I definitely don't want to set up the position that small is good and big is bad, because I don't think that's the case. But wait, I'm curious, you know, labor is a competitive market, and I think what I've been hearing from a lot of farmers, there's just not a ton of farm workers out there. There's not this kind of like group of individuals who have answered the call that farm work has become a position that is essentially unwanted by others. And I think in New York State in particular, thinking about the dairy industry, which is such a big part of our agricultural economy here, that farmers are already so stretched at the margins, and there's a real concern that any additional push from a wage perspective is only going to drive them deeper into an already kind of deep hole. And I'm wondering how, you know, how we should be responding to that, and what do we say to those people? Where do we kind of look elsewhere in the food system to correct that problem?
You know, I mean, I would love to sit down and talk with the folks who are facing that reality, because to be honest, if you look at the numbers, it's really not there. I mean, the the dairy industry in New York is being highly favored and subsidized by the government. This administration is doing a lot to increase the yield and production of dairy farms and the yogurt industry, and it's actually experiencing a boon right now. And the dairy industry of all the farmer, all the types of different farms in the agricultural sector is one that you actually can see the very, you know, similarities between a farm worker on a dairy farm who goes in every day because cows have to be milked every day, and you know, and it's a very industrialized form of agriculture and very regularized, and these type of basic labor protections are just par for the course in industries like that. So, I mean, I think that there's very real concerns, and if there are economic impacts that you know, increases in wages might put people out of business. We're just not seeing that right now with regards to the numbers of the industry as a whole.
But I guess also I feel like what I've been hearing from folks is like it's not necessary to make it a law, because if you're running a good business, it's in your interest to treat your employees well. And if you don't treat them well, they'll leave. So I want to kind of open this up. Maggie, you're kind of giving me a smile there. That's something I'm hearing. I'm curious, you know, how you might respond to that. Or John, actually, if you want to.
Yeah. Where are you going to go? That's one of the things. The farmers, but if you want to take the whole food supply chain, it's the largest private sector employer. The two largest private sector employers individually is retail and restaurants. So we're talking about industries that are universally low wage, universally no benefits. So this is just the nature of our economy. It's moved to a service economy, and the production that does exist, a lot of it is along the food chain. So these things of go find another job or go somewhere else, it's not just how it happens. And we've seen the ramifications in New York City of when we don't have some of these laws. So, for example, to take the industry I know best, in the restaurant industry, I worked 12 years, did not ever have a paid sick day in my life. I worked sick multiple times, coughed on people's food, didn't want to, things that's really gross. And I worked in a fine dining restaurant. And let's go to San Francisco, which does not have a tip minimum wage. So that means their tipped workers actually make their regular minimum wage, which is about 10 something an hour. They have universal paid sick days for all their workers. It doesn't cut anyone out like they are going to do in New York City. And their restaurant industry is booming. And after the fact, employers who actually were against paid sick days, as one example, have now come out and said that it works great, that their turnover is lower, their productivity is higher. And that actually goes, I think, I don't know much about the dairy industry, but I would say part of with dairy and farming or any of this is that they're not going to have the benefits, so there's not going to be an attraction to workers. If you make it a good job, people will come and do that job, and they'll stay there and they'll do good work.
And I'm hoping, Librata, maybe you can give us a sense of, you know, how you would respond to that. Well, if the working conditions aren't good, why don't you just leave? Or why don't you go find a job elsewhere, because that's an option.
Yes, definitely I wanted to respond to this, but I want to go back to one point where we're talking about, like, I mean, is it the small farmers that's going to be affected or the large farmers going to be, like, you know, stuff like that? And basically, I think Megan explained it really well, but I do wanted to add that, we're talking about when the big farms are in here and then calling themselves family farms and stuff like that, when they have so many workers, over 100 workers. I know our farmers who have over 100 workers here. And then they have crew leaders and stuff like that. So, and then when they have crew leaders in between, they don't even know what's going on with the workers, because they also do, you know what, you're in charge of this group, you're in charge of this group, I don't want to hear about it. You deal with it, you know, or stuff like that. And then so also that's going to really help us out to prevent abuses from the crew leaders. Sometimes because of the English languages various, you know, people cannot speak English, and sometimes they cannot complain directly to the farmers or something like that, because sometimes supervisors maybe get a little bit of, you know, a dollar over each person or something like that, you know, but whatever it is. But sometimes they also cover what's in to the they also sometimes they also cover what's going on with the workers instead of like going directly to the farmers. Sometimes, like I can tell you, like abuses, sexual abuses, or you know, verbal abuses, and you know, like, oh, you know what, I'm the one who is also doing the rules here or something. If you don't like it, you can be fired, or if you don't like it, you can go ahead. Even if you go to the farmer is gonna say, oh, you know what, you can leave if you don't like the job, stuff like that, you know. So basically, what we're talking about it here is that to make these rules so we can stop all these abuses that's going on, because basically, I mean, so many things going on right now. And also, even if they fire the people, the problem is that if they fire one and then another people is going to come in, and but the rules do not change. And that's what we're talking about. I mean, we want the rules to protect workers no matter who's come, no matter who's going, and stuff like that. We're talking about the rules and the farm. And that's what we're talking about, because people can come and go, which is not easy for them, of course. Sometimes they have to speak whatever the people say or whatever the crew leader says, because it's not easy for them to move from one place to another place, or if they just came in from another state and then go back to another state, it's so hard for them, you know? And sometimes that's why they don't speak up, because they don't want to lose the job, and they'd rather stay on whatever the condition that they are in order for them to have the job. And so it's not fair. That's what we're talking about. That's not fair. So let's give these people a right so they can defend, they can talk, they can, you know, do what's right for them.
Well, if you've just joined us, we are discussing the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. We are going to take a quick break. You've been listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Hang tight. We'll be back for more of this fascinating discussion.
Right now, you're listening to a song called Cheese Gainsbourg from TaxStar, and this is HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
All right, we are back. You're tuned into a special community session on the Heritage Radio Network, and we are discussing the Farm Worker Fair Labor Practices Act. We are on the line with Wade McMullen and Labrada Paz, and then in studio with Maggie Gray and John Cronin Jr. And what I want to jump into now is a section of the proposed legislation, which calls calls to provide a sanitary code that shall apply to all farm and food processing labor camps intended to house migrant workers, regardless of the number of occupants. And often farms will, in addition to a wage, also provide housing and sometimes provide a transportation. And that is kind of goes into the wage package or the benefits package. You know, I'm not sure how best to quantify it, but maybe we can talk a little bit about these living conditions and what the kind of current expectation is of housing that's provided by the farmer. If Maggie, you want to start?
Sure. So I think talking about housing links directly back to your other question about why not complain, why not just go somewhere else. So for so many of these workers, their job is tied to their housing. So when you leave a job, you pretty much lost everything. And they live in such poverty that the idea of scraping together funds for a security deposit for an apartment down the road is just unrealistic. So I think we have to understand how high the stakes are. In addition, we haven't really brought this up, but the vast majority of farm workers in the state are not documented. So their options are few. Historically, farm work is the industry that it's easiest for the undocumented to get into. We know there's been a real expansion of those jobs, particularly in the food industry over the last 20 years. But in terms of housing really ranges on farms. I've visited farms where workers are living in a pretty nice house. Sometimes farmers house families, even non-working members of the family. Other times you'll go in and the trailers will be really run down. I've seen windows covered up with cardboard. I've seen missing steps going into trailers. I've definitely seen overcrowding. I mean, I can vividly picture a couple of trailers where you go in and there would be sort of five bare mattresses, one on top of the other in the living room, which workers spread out on the floor at nighttime, in addition to the other bedrooms, which are housing workers. So overcrowding is certainly an issue. I know housing is also a real challenge for farmers. This is something they can get very frustrated about. You'll have farmers who feel that they're trying to keep housing up and the workers are making too much of a mess, and it becomes this cycle. You know, a farmer might think, well, why should I maintain this better? Farmers are certainly aware when the trailers are 30 or 40 years old and need to be replaced, but it's just a matter of trying to scrape together the funds on their part to upgrade the housing. And there's a real issue in New York State about providing farm worker housing. There's not enough of it to go around for the workers who really need housing. In addition, the other obstacle for farmers is that there are very strict rules about farm worker housing. So I spoke to a farmer a few years ago, and right across the street from the farm was a house, you know, a house that a family had been living in, and it was going into foreclosure. And at first they were so excited, oh, perfect. But it turned out that there wasn't the proper window to square foot ratio to qualify under the sanitary code. So, I mean, I think that looking at housing from both perspectives, it can be very challenging for farmers. But most of the time, farmers aren't living in the farm worker housing. And oftentimes, farmer housing is just down the road from the farm worker housing. And that contrast can be really striking, the difference between the farmer housing and the farm worker housing.
Wade, I don't know if you had anything to add there with regards to the sanitary code or improvements on that particular aspect.
No, definitely. I think it's just something that people don't think about when they think about farm workers' rights. And, you know, with a lot of the agricultural industry employing a workforce that's migratory, so not just, you know, potentially coming across the border into our country, but just moving from New York down all the way to Florida following the growing and the picking seasons, that's the reasons, part of the reasons why farmers and growers must provide this housing. And just like Maggie was describing, people would probably be appalled at on the worst end of the spectrum, because, you know, we should all be recognizing that there are farmers out there who treat their workers excellently and do provide good housing. But on the far end of the spectrum, because there, you know, are kind of lax limitations by way of allowing farm workers to complain and bargain collectively, as well as these sanitary codes, the housing looks like something that you would see, you know, in a trash dump in the middle of Central America, you know, just corrugated tin shacks and lots of overcrowding. And of course, that's not, you know, every housing for farm workers, but it exists because of lack of protections in the labor code.
Just a real quick note, a lot of people talk about migrant workers, and, you know, if you want to go back 20, 30 and more years, yes, the majority of seasonal workers in the state were migrant workers, but today they're not. What we really see is a credible shift to the number of workers who are living year-round in the state, and they're living in this housing year-round. Sometimes they don't have the proper winterized protection because the housing wasn't designed for year-round living. This is really a result of our immigration policies and tightening our southern border, where you used to have more cyclical migration. Workers could come in when the jobs were here and then go home with ease. They can't really do that anymore. The other aspect is that the traditional worker to New York State between World War II and the early 80s was an African-American migrant who started in Florida and worked her or his way up the East Coast. And you don't really find African-American workers in New York farms anymore. It's largely Latinos.
Well, I've just gotten word from Jack. We are joined on the line by New York State Senator Adriano Espiat. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for inviting me, and I am happy to be on board with this effort.
So now you represent District 31, which is not a particularly rural section of the state. So I'm curious, why have you become such an advocate for this particular piece?
Well, you know, first and foremost, I think that any injustice in New York State, and particularly as egregious as what farm workers are going through, should be addressed by all members, no matter where you come from. And although we don't have any farms in my district, you know, we do have green markets and people, residents of my district, constituents of my district, purchase produce that are picked by farm workers. And I think that's a deep, dark secret in New York State, the conditions that farm workers are working under, not many people know about. So I was happy to be part of a mobilization a couple of weeks ago where we began to bring information to the green markets in the city, letting them know what the conditions are. And today I got the good word that we had Senator Tim Kennedy from Buffalo slipped the bill, and he's one of the sponsors now. So we're up to 27 sponsors.
Oh, I think we may have just lost you. Do you say we're up to 27 sponsors?
That's correct. We have 27 sponsors for the bill, and there are other folks that have expressed their support informally, and I hope that they will be coming on board. So we have some momentum, and I'm very excited to be part of this.
So I'm curious, you know, for folks who are out there listening and want to engage further on this issue, what's the best way for people to get involved?
You know, people should call senators that are opposed to it, but most importantly, those senators that have shown some support but are still not sponsors of the bill, such as Senator Robach from Rochester and Marcelino from Long Island. These are two allies that in the past have shown support for this bill, and I think that folks, advocates, should call them to thank them for their past support, and to encourage to also sponsor the bill again. And finally, I think the IDC, the Independent Democratic Conference, and Senator Jeff Klein, which has four members, could prove to be the decisive number of votes that we need to push this across the finish line.
Excellent. Well, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for being an advocate for these folks and on this issue. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me. Thank you so much.
I want to give everyone else a chance to make some recommendations for folks who want to get engaged. But before we jump back, one thing I do want to touch on while we have a little time left is the provision that calls to provide for a 10-hour workday for farm laborers. And I'm curious, you know, in New York State, you know, obviously the growing season is different than in other parts of the country, and I think there is an intense pressure, especially during the summer months, to get what you can out of the season, and that probably in most cases will include pushing past a traditional 10-hour workday for a seasonal worker. And I'm wondering if anyone has any response to, you know, how producers might deal with this provision, or why it is of 10 hours is kind of the right number. And Maggie, if we'll maybe start with you.
Yeah. So two comments. The first is, I think a lot of us imagine, oh, there might be a 2-week period where the harvest is so intense and you're working very long hours. The fact of the matter is it's often more than 2 weeks. I mean, I've met workers who log 80 to 90 hours a week for a couple of months running. I mean, in one case, I didn't really believe them. They claimed that they would often be working until 10 or 11 o'clock at night in the packing shed. And so I drove past a couple times in September, and indeed they were. So, you know, I don't think this is a case where, oh, the demands of the harvest, because, you know, the harvest is often ongoing week after week after week. I think that from the economic reality, I want to say two main points. One is, I've really looked at the history of Hudson Valley farmers going back a couple of centuries, and it's a story of constant challenges and of the need to constantly adapt. And farmers have done this pretty successfully over time. And I think all the evidence shows that whenever a new challenge arises, farmers will adapt again. They will figure out the way to adapt. These are some of the most savvy business people that you can meet. I think the other part of it is, if you go back and look at, you know, you said before that farmers sometimes say, well, you know, we don't need to have these formalized. We're going to just treat our workers well. The Farm Bureau will point out to you that the statistics show the average farm worker makes, you know, on average, farm workers make $10 an hour in New York State and work 60 hours a week. So if we just start there, and if we're imagining that that's the average case, so if I fit within that average case and I hire workers and I'm paying them $10 an hour and they work 60 hours a week and this overtime provision comes in, right? After 10 hours, I have to pay them overtime. If I want them to work any part of a seventh day, I have to pay them overtime. If I'm already paying them $10, this is a pretty simple formula. In the end, all my workers want to know is, at the end of the year, they're going to make the same amount of money. And I have a lot of flexibility if I'm paying $10 an hour to lower their base wage. And that will help make up for the overtime pay. Okay, so if we look at the statistics again, after 10 hours a week, if the average worker is working 60 hours a week, then there's not really overtime involved there. Well, going back to what Wade was saying about unfair competition, I think for these farmers that are paying well, for these farmers who are not expecting 90-hour work weeks repeated, this isn't really a problem for them. All they have to do is just adjust their wage rates. They also have some flexibility. Many offer free housing. They can start to charge a little bit for housing. They offer free electricity. They have the flexibility to start charging for that. And so then you might ask, well, if the farm workers are going to make the same in the end, what's the point? And I think the point would be that I have met a lot of workers who make the minimum wage, the absolute minimum wage. I've met workers who put, you know, they're logging 90 hours a week some weeks and they only make the minimum wage and they have teenage daughters who are babysitting and making $3, $4, or $5 more an hour than they are. It's degrading to them to make this sort of salary. And, you know, to go back to this question of, well, they could leave or why don't they say anything, I think really overlooks this gross power disparity between a mostly white employer, white, educated, English-speaking citizen employer, and a non-English-speaking, not formally educated, not citizen worker, you know, who comes from a totally different culture. So I think it makes it so different to challenge. But I do think this is a reasonable question. Why not just challenge the conditions? And again, I really think the farmers I've spoken to, some of them already imagining, oh, okay, how am I going to deal with this? I'll have to charge for housing. I'll have to do this. I think when you read the newspaper, they'll say what's going to happen is they're going to have to cut their workforce. They're going to have to cut down on hours. Farm workers aren't going to get as many hours. And the farmers who are going to feel the most as a result of this are the ones who are paying the bare minimum wage and expecting tremendous hours out of their workers. And I think those are exactly the farmers that we'd like to see treating their workers better, especially for foodies who can then, you know, when you're eating your asparagus, you can feel more comfortable about it. And then New York, you know, we talk about New York pride in agriculture, New York pride. And why not have pride in the fact that we have incredible labor rights in the state and that we can make this statement and really make this a selling point?
Wade, I'm curious about your response to that, but, and also if we throw in this idea that, you know, won't this make food more expensive? And food is already expensive for so many people that's another concern that folks have to worry about.
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it's a really important thing to be dealing with. I mean, there's a study that was published in the New York Times, wrote about it. You know, if we raised, you know, this was a study across America, and if we raised the average farm worker wage, annual wage, to just above the poverty line, there would be, you know, something along the line of a 40% wage increase for your average farm worker in all of America, which sounds huge. And if you then passed on all of those costs to the consumer, you're talking about $15 a year increase in your average consumer's fruits and vegetables budget. And so I think what Maggie was alluding to and just saying outright that, you know, farmers are, you know, the hardiest of us and are going to be able to adapt. And when we're talking about an industry now that's subsidized by weak labor protections that, you know, have their roots in a discriminatory past, and I don't think any farmer, you know, feels like their industry is dependent on the, these kind of lax and discriminatory regulations, and I really do believe that this isn't going to increase food prices to the point of pricing people out of the market. It's always a conversation we should be having, and we should always be analyzing the types of effects for our principled arguments on civil rights. But here, I just don't think it's the case.
Well, one of the other things that I've heard in response to this bill is also that, you know, giving workers the right to organize, giving them the right to strike, you know, that really puts farmers over a barrel. You know, let's say it's time to pick the broccoli because there's a frost coming in, and the workers have a lot of power in that moment to essentially say, hey, you know, we're not going to go out into the fields and you're going to lose your whole harvest unless you agree to our terms. And I'm curious what the response to that might be.
Yeah, definitely. And that's an extremely valid concern. And we also have to not be careful not to conflate the right to strike with the right to engage in collective bargaining, right? So you look at the National Labor Relations Act, for example, and, you know, these kind of collective bargaining provisions actually reduced the number of strikes nationally when they were put in place and stabilized labor relations. You look at places like California or Wisconsin who have dairy workers, and if a cow has to be milked every day, so if a dairy worker strikes and the cows aren't milked, and then there's health problems and the product suffers. They have collective bargaining provisions that also have very, you know, common sense provisions about cooling off periods, or, you know, you enter into mandatory arbitration, but the workers continue to work, or you have notification requirements. And I think the thing that farm worker advocates who've been pushing for a Bill of Rights for some time are a little tired of is these general accusations that the bill isn't good enough, therefore we're going to reject it wholesale. And if anybody who's concerned about, you know, striking in these kind of where farm workers hold the upper hand situations, come to the table with language, specific language, common sense language that exists in places like Wisconsin, California, other places that give these rights to farm workers. And I don't see any problem moving forward to, you know, grant collective bargaining, but also have provisions in there to take care of these concerns.
So, you know, workers could go on strike right now, right? So it's not as though this bill is going to be an invitation to striking. It's also not really an invitation for unions to come in because they're not necessarily waiting in the wings. I think we're a long time off from a unionized farm workforce in New York State. But let's just be clear what collective bargaining protections are. I mean, if we worked on a farm, the three of us, and we went to talk to the employer and said, hey, you know, we'd like a 20-cent raise, we could get fired, and that's the end of the story. If we have collective bargaining protections, we have a little bit more remedy there. Wade, you can correct me if I'm wrong there. But I think it's really about having a collective voice. And there are plenty of instances, and I'm sure Librat has seen them, where you'll have a group of farm workers in New York State. I know several cases where they go and they ask for a 5-cent raise. And they get fired for asking for a raise. And so let's just be clear what collective bargaining is. Collective bargaining is not, okay, bring in the unions and now we're just going to change the landscape of farming in New York. It's, you know, it's that's just not going to happen.
yeah, I'd like to add to that as well that when farm workers are going to be able to actually sit and negotiate the terms of their work and actually have us increase their conditions to a better standard, it gives them also a higher sense of pride over their work and a little bit more control. And our studies even have shown that when workers have higher standards in the workplace, that workplace conditions, things like paid sick days, like higher wages, like scheduling, hours, overtime pay, not being subject to wage theft, have a direct correlation to health and safety standards in the workplace at the same time. And I think it's especially crucial when we're talking about the food system. We're talking about daily our food is at risk because our workers are at risk. And that's something that I'm not sure that everyone realizes when they go into their farmers markets and when they go to their restaurants. I have some ways I can plug in, but I can talk about that when we get to that.
I just wanted to address also, the last version of the bill I saw had a cooling off period in it. And so there was an actual preventing a long-term strike from happening and making sure that harvests weren't spoiled was part of the language of the bill.
So,
yeah, that was in 2010, the version that finally made it to the floor for a vote at that time. I think the current vision is an omnibus bill that just removed those exclusions. And the specific language this time around is yet to be negotiated.
So unfortunately, we are just about out of time. But before we wrap up, I want to give everyone an opportunity to kind of briefly, give their plug for what they think are some great next steps for folks who might be out there listening. And Labrada, I think we'll start with you.
I mean, definitely. What we're trying to do right now is to raise awareness again. We're going to go to May 13th to lobby and all those things. So we definitely try to get more allies to support us and all those things. And also, we have a website where we try to raise more awareness and also do a fundraising at the same time. So the website is indiegogo.com. So if anybody is interested, to go and check it out and then look for Librada Paz, Farm Workers, right in your state, and then they should be able to find it. And then basically, I mean, we are like what Maggie and everybody else says, you know, we just wanted to put those protections to the workers because they really needed it. Working 80 hours for a very minimum wages, I just don't think it's just fair. So that's what we got to focus on, you know. Come on, let's give these people a little bit of rest, better condition, and better a little bit of everything, you know, because like what we were saying before, it's just, you know, let's just make it right.
Thank you. Thank you so much for joining us. Wade?
Yeah, I echo what Labrada is saying. There is a whole bunch of us headed up to Albany on May 13th to let lawmakers know that this is an important issue. And so if anybody looking to join us can contact Rural and Migrant Ministry, who's organizing these efforts to have an advocacy day in Albany. Also, I just say, you know, even right here, right there in Brooklyn, Simca Felder, who is a state senator, is yet to sign on to the bill. So any of the listeners out there in his district, to write him a letter, go visit his office and tell him, you know, you heard about this issue and you wanted to express your concern for what's going on in Albany, and would love to count on his support. So those are two really tangible ways to get involved, and I think that just having this conversation is a great first step for many of us. So thank you.
And Maggie?
Oh, I'd just like to point out that, especially for the listeners to this radio station, if you look at the research, consumers are so responsible for helping to create more organics, lowering pesticide, protecting the environment, making sure animals are protected better. And I think that just as a consumer, start asking the same questions. You know, I mean, I talk to farmers who say, ugh, I created a handout because too many people ask about my pesticide practices. And then I say, and who asked labor? And they say, nobody has ever asked me a question about my workers. And I think I would also just add to it, you know, if you're not prepared yet to say, are you paying your workers overtime? Then ask about the workers. You know, they're people too. There are so many human interest stories that profile the farmers. Where did they come from? Why are they in farming? What's the story of their family? That even just, you know, hey, how many workers do you have? And where did they come from? And how long have they been with you? Right? Just to, I mean, essentially to humanize what right now is really a largely hidden workforce. So I would say consumers who are really caring about their food, let's really start to include questions about workers in the food movement conversation.
Great. Thank you. John?
Okay. I think this whole conversation has showed that the need that farmers are just one sector of the food industry and the food chain, and that it shows the need to unite along the whole food chain. So there are some campaigns that are along the food chain that the Food Chain Workers Alliance member organizations are engaged in right now. One is the Dignity at Darden campaign. Darden Restaurants is the largest full-service restaurant group in the world. They own Red Lobster, Olive Garden, and we're actually organizing workers at their fine dining steakhouse, the Capital Grill. So if you go to dignityatdarden.org, you can sign into a petition. And also, anytime you go into a restaurant, you know, ask ask the server what are their conditions, what they're doing. Take a look and look at the segregation of the restaurant with the white servers and the people of color in the back. Also, the Restaurant Opportunity Center United has a national diner's guide where we rate the top restaurants in the country based on their labor standards, whether they give paid sick days, pay a certain amount of wages, etc. Also, the Coalition of Immokalee Workers, which is a farm worker group in Immokalee, Florida, has a campaign against Wendy's right now to try to be able to pay one penny more per pound for tomatoes and other fair labor standards. And so just to really think about where the food's coming from, because like you said, the green stuff has been pushed by consumers because they ask the right questions and because they show some solidarity to workers. And the last thing is May 1st is coming up next Wednesday, May Day, International Workers' Day. And this is a great day to unite immigrant rights and workers' rights and the rights that are for all. And we're going to be in the streets on May 1st. There's a big rally at Union Square at 4 p.m.
Thanks, and thanks for everyone taking part in the panel today, and Senator Espiot for joining us by phone. Also want to send a thanks out to the other folks who helped make this possible. First and foremost, our sponsor, Tabert Inn and Route 11 Potato Chips. And then big thank you to Julia Sullivan of Haven's Kitchen for helping coordinate, the folks over at New York University, the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights, the ACLU, the Brooklyn Coalition, tons of great people on board. I definitely encourage those out you listening to take the advice of any one of our panelists or all of them, if you're feeling ambitious, and get engaged in this issue, educate yourself, form your own opinion, and then activate. Thank you so much for tuning in to this special community sessions on the Heritage Radio Network. This, like all 30 of our live weekly shows, is available for free as a download through iTunes, or you can find us on Stitcher Smart Radio. You can also visit our website, www.heritageradionetwork.org. If you like what you're hearing and you want to support our work, we hope you'll click that donate tab and become a member today. Thanks so much for listening, and keep tuning in.